Welcome to Scuderia F1, the podcast that's always up to speed with the latest Formula One news. Follow us on Twitter at Scuderia F1 Pod and subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Daly and Kevin Laramie.
Hey everybody, what is up? Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Mark Daly here, welcome you back to the show. And a little heads up, there are going to be no monologues or rants, or at least not in the opener at any rate, because this is the second part of the two-part special that I did with my good friends Mark Hamilton and Gilbert Gamboa of the Flash F1 podcast and Tim Haraney of TSN Sports. So being a two-part podcast, you don't necessarily have to go back and listen to part one because we kind of jump around and cover a broad range of topics. But just a little bit of a heads up, this second part does start sort of midway through a discussion. So just for the sake of continuity, if you did miss part one, you might just want to go back and at least listen to the last 10 minutes of that show, first of all, if you just want to jump into this one straight away. Anyways, that's enough for me. Time to go back to the studio with myself, Mark, and Gil from Flash F1 and Tim Haraney of TSN Sports. Enjoy.
That clearly was a relationship that had gone past its best before date. Because absolutely. When we came into the V6 turbo hybrid era in 2014, Horner was even saying stuff back then that, you know, it wasn't frustration or any animosity. It was just like, they're clearly a step behind compared to Ferrari and Mercedes. Mm-hmm. And that relationship just degraded over years. And then I think it was really unparalleled. I cannot think of another situation in Formula One where you had a team like Red Bull and with their junior team in Toro Rosso was basically able to demo both engines in their cars at the same time and make that decision, like weighing them up like apples and apples. Okay, well, the Honda's the better engine than the Renault. And everybody's like, really? Like, have you not just been watching the past couple of years with those Honda engines at the back of the McLaren? So that was like an unparalleled situation, but it's certainly like that faith that they, or that leap of faith that they took, really seems to be paying off, because of what Tim was talking about, just that synergy that teamwork that they have with Honda, where the car and the power unit are integrated rather than Red Bull, Renault, try and put them together. Yeah. Hey, they don't fit.
Well, I remember, and it's nice to see how far Honda's actually come from, because I remember 2017, I was in Spain for preseason testing and I was covering it. And I remember McLaren had such a tough time getting that car to the track, around the track, because every time I would sit there,
and that was year three of the Honda relationship.
You can always tell, for like people who are hardcore racers or people who have raced, you know, you can always sit at a racetrack and you'd be like, that's a Corvette coming. Sure enough, here comes a Corvette. That's a Ferrari coming. Sure enough, that's a Ferrari. You just know the tones and you know what's coming. I remember sitting there being like, here comes a Ferrari, because they had this distinct whistle that came from the turbo. And then I'd be like, here comes the Mercedes, because it was like one of the quieter engines. And then I'd be like, what the hell is that? Because it sounded like gravel being chewed up inside of an old tin can. And I was like, what is that? And then this orange and black thing comes out of nowhere.
I bet you Fernando Alonso had the exact same reaction.
And you could actually hear how much it struggled just to get the power down. I was at the second last corner at the Circuit de Catalunya there, the chicane, and just trying, you could hear Alonso like in the car, like trying to just literally push it forward by himself because there was no traction coming out of the turn. The engine just wasn't picking up. It was almost like there was like a low oil level somewhere that the piston was having trouble firing. Like, it was just like, oh my God, what is going on? What is this?
Does anybody remember, was it Fernando before the Russian Grand Prix when he was even struggling to get to the starting grid?
Yeah.
And he's complaining over
drive
the radio.
It back.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, I've tried everything, you drive it. Yeah. So typical Fernando.
What would you guys think was a more toxic relationship? Hamilton Rosberg or McLaren / Fernando? Nintendo slash Honda.
That should never have gone that far. No, if yeah. if you're like, I love Fernando Alonso, but if you're an athlete of that level, like, there has to be some level of professionalism. Yep. And you can't criticize Honda like that. I mean, no. You do have to have respect for what they've actually done in the sport.
Yeah,
I agree.
You do, because they have won so many titles. Yep. They've done so much for racing drivers in the sport.
He did nothing to help the cause.
Nothing
at all.
Nothing.
And I was a Fernando fan, but even in the moment, I just, like, him getting on the radio and talking about them and talking about them in the press and talking about them to anyone that would live, like, it wasn't helping the relationship. It wasn't fostering synergy. It wasn't fostering a collaborative spirit. And ultimately, I kind of think it's a miracle that Honda's still in the sport. And I'm incredibly happy that they're still in the sport, because it's creating a great relationship with them and Red Bull and Toro Rosso.
I mean, seeing them win this season.
It was a feel-good moment.
Unbelievable. Yeah. If you go on Twitter and you go to the Honda Racing Twitter account, and all the stuff that was coming out on their Twitter account was it was awesome. It was just so nice to see. And I was so happy for them, in all honesty. Yeah. Just all the things they've been through for the past few years with the teams and everything, and to finally have figured it out and put it together. And you had another team that believed in you, kind of deal. Yep. Like, it was
great to re-energize that fan base in Japan as well. We forget that there's 130 million people in that country, and they are crazy for motorsports. Yeah. And they're crazy for Formula One. Yeah. And this re-energizes that fan base.
Oh. Yeah. I've only been to Japan once, and that was in 2007. And everywhere you went in Tokyo, there was a billboard with Lewis Hamilton on it.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. Like, even back then, I mean, that would have been Lewis's first year in F1, wouldn't it? 2001? Yeah. 2007. 2007.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah. It was really, really cool.
Every race I've been at, the number of Japanese fans that follow the tour and they go to every single stop to support Lewis Hamilton is bananas. Like, we've stood in line to meet Lewis Hamilton, and we're surrounded with Japanese fans, and they are absolutely obsessed, and they traveled. Like, the level of commitment that those fans have is crazy.
Yeah.
And we talk about Lewis being that transcendent star. Well, that's another example, because there is no current homegrown Formula One star in Formula One from Japan, and they latch on to Lewis, which is great to see.
Yeah, another cool thing about Japan is you can go anywhere in that country and there's a vending machine.
Yeah.
You're out in the middle of nowhere, there's a vending machine. Yeah. You can get, like, you can get something to drink, you can get a pack of cigarettes and a fresh pair of underwear, you know?
That's awesome.
It's like, it's everything. Yeah. I mean, to anyone else, it sounds kind of bizarre, but if you're Japanese, it's like, well, why wouldn't you have something that could be in here?
Why wouldn't there be underwear in her?
It's good to know. I'm thinking of going to Japan next month for my birthday and attend the Blackpink concert right after. So,
there you go. Well, they got you covered for anything you need.
Perfect.
Yeah. But just going back to Fernando there, I mean, his legacy in Formula One to me is one of a guy, an extremely fast, extremely talented driver, probably should have won more than two world championships.
Oh, yeah.
But he burned way too many bridges. Yep. Wherever he went, he burned a lot of bridges.
He's passionate, yet... Yeah. I felt that he was a bit selfish, and that's the exact word I would use, is selfish. That his frustration just led to the dissolvement of his relationship with the team, and just him leaving, just his conduct and the way he performed with the team just didn't really sit well. Didn't really sit well with me. You know, he had that attitude like, oh, I'm a world champion, I've done this before, give me what I need.
Yeah.
me.
Yeah.
And it didn't sit well with me towards the latter half of his career.
I think, like, I hate criticizing Fernando Alonso, because I think he is one of the greatest racing drivers ever. I honestly.
Oh, I agree. He's got skills. He's got skills. Just the way he conducts himself.
I think Ferrari and the problems that Ferrari have had, I think a lot of that stems from the Alonso days. And I think it is just one of those things that has taken so long to get cleaned up with inside the actual team that I think that's one of the reasons which kind of has set them back. And another thing is, you know, I think, you know, having Vettel there to replace him was a good move, because I feel that Vettel was the driver that actually kind of helped steer this Ferrari ship kind of back on track, if you were to say so. And that kind of opens the door now for Leclerc, where he's now coming into a team that has a little bit more form to it than, you know, what it did have when Vettel showed up.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. The last race that that we went to was the Spanish Grand Prix in 2014. So that was the last year of Danny Ricciardo and Sebastian Vettel, and that was Kimi Raikkonen and Fernando Alonso. So it was just sort of this previous to this generation or this iteration of Formula One. It was kind of interesting how it's all sort of moved forward from here. And of course, there's a couple of teams that were on the grid then that don't exist anymore. Yeah. But I guess that that is Formula One. But yeah, Fernando, he is an interesting case study, and it's just the one thing that it's just interesting how his tenure in Formula One ended, because when he left McLaren, it was kind of open-ended. It's still, you know, and he's still saying he'd like to go back in 2021. He's dropped those hints, but I just can't see it happening.
Do you see a team that would on that shadow?
No way.
I don't think
so. There's too much baggage.
I think he would be open to it, but I don't think any team on the grid is willing
he's
to take
burnt
that
too many bridges with 100%. His conduct. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I remember the first Grand Prix I went to was the 2001 European Grand Prix at the Nürburgring.
Wow.
So I can actually say that I've seen both Verstappen's race in Formula One. You know, Jos the Boss, which was kind of cool. He was like,
that's cool.
I kid you not, he was like Orange Arrows, exactly. He was like a cult figure in the Netherlands at that time, because I'm Dutch Canadian. I was living in Holland at the time, and he was like a really massive. So it was kind of cool to see both of them race in
the Boss.
In yeah.
Love the Boss.
But also going back to 2001, of course, that sort of peak Schumacher era, but also that was just about the time when Jenson Button was just coming into Formula One.
Yep.
Alonso was in Formula One. I guess you'll go back to like one of the classic names of Formula One that never really accomplished anything. Yeah. That was Minardi. But I mean, some of the names, some of the guys that
the
raced
drivers
that team
came out of Minardi.
Yeah. The legacy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Minardi was one of those teams that gave so many drivers that opportunity. And have you ever heard like Alonso's very first time in the Minardi, like on a race weekend? Have you guys ever heard that story?
No, His
first time down pit lane in a Minardi. Schumacher is in front of him at the end of pit lane, and they're waiting for the red light to go green so they can go out on track for the first practice session. And he comes down screaming down pit lane with the pit lane limiter on. He sees that the light's red. He's like, oh crap, I got to stop. So he starts stopping. He's like, where's neutral? Searching all over the steering wheel as he's screaming towards Schumacher, and at the last second finds neutral, hits the brakes.
Wow
that's cool.
I hadn't heard that.
The cool thing about going to that race in 2001 was being able to experience peak Schumacher mania in Germany at the time. That was something. And also those normally aspirated cars.
Yes. Yeah.
Because we went with a group of about 8 or 9 or 10 of us, and we were sitting at the bottom of the track in the where the big hairpin is. And it's really cool because at the Nürburgring, when they come down the hill through a series of S's into the hairpin, then they go up, and then there's a real quick left-hander up at the top of the hill. So you roughly see the cars for about 25 to 30 seconds, which is a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
At a racetrack, but it was really cool. And I remember, you know, you're there for the whole weekend and you watch the different support races and you know the cars are loud. But when you get that entire field of 20 or 22 cars, whatever it was back in 2001, when they come around for the first several laps while they're still grouped together, and you're sitting there and you're sitting with all your friends, you're trying to soak up the atmosphere. But when those cars come by, you realize that they give you those little foam earplugs for a reason. Mm-hmm. And then you're literally covering your ears, like, because your head feels like it wants to explode.
Yeah.
And then when we were in Spain in 2014 for the Grand Prix there, it was amazing.
You know,
we were sitting at just pretty much opposite the exit to the pit lane. And, you know, the cars are going by and, you know, when you walk into the track, they give you the earplugs and so it's like, well, I put these back in my pocket.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, the stark difference between it was absolutely amazing.
Being part of the Renault driver development program and stuff, we toured around a bit with Formula One. And I remember in 2004, Villeneuve was in, I think he was in the Bar Honda at the time. I remember talking to him about it because, you know, he always gave some good advice, but you know, I always asked him not what the sound of the engine was like, because the engine actually will rattle your eyes, and it's kind of, you need the like those soundproof molded earplugs, because some people are like, oh, so they can talk to the team. It's like, actually, one of the reasons is because it shakes your eyeballs out of your head. Yeah. You literally start seeing double as you're racing, and you just can't focus. You can't drive, basically. So I had always asked him, you know, what was the downshift, like the downshifts on these cars like? Because at that time, they're very violent, very aggressive, and he said they'd blow the air out of his lungs. And so during a qualifying session, I was like, hey, you know what? I got nothing to do. I'm done with the team. We're done analyzing data. I'm going to go watch F1 qualify, because usually I just sit in the trailer and watch it on satellite TV that we had there. So anyways, walked out to the track and stood by one of the hairpins, and the car's coming by. I had to plug my ears. And then when they slammed on the brakes and started downshifting, you could actually feel the ground like shake underneath your feet.
Wow. Yeah.
And I will never forget that, because the power that was just,
The power is you could hear it, you could feel it. Yeah. I mean, you could experience it. And the other thing in 2001 that impressed upon me as well is you could hear the traction control.
Yeah.
When it was, it made like this
spitting, like, yeah. You just hear it missing, really, misfiring. And yeah. Just like, you knew the traction control was on, and you could tell the levels of traction, who had the best traction control at that time, because you could hear how many times it was correcting and all this other kind of stuff. But
the one thing that really amazes me, though, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The one thing besides that really amazes me, going from, say, that gap of you know, almost 20 years now, I mean, heaven forbid, but is not just the straight line speed that these cars they had then, but just how much quicker they are through the corners now in modern Formula One. It is, they really are, like,
downforce, you know, levels are incredible.
It's amazing. It really is amazing.
It's like you wonder why they can't race, right?
Yeah.
It's like, if everyone's braking at the 50 meter mark before the corner, how are you supposed to pass? You can't pass.
Where's the opportunity?
It's like, oh, well, we've made another hairpin. Well, that's great. Like, how are you going to pass into there? Everyone's braking at the same
time. Well, you raise an interesting point there, because Danny Ricciardo has this reputation of being a late breaker. If they're all braking at 50 meters, where's Danny braking at? 49 and a half?
At that point, but then you're like, oh, at that point, the driver in front of you is going to start to turn. So you're just going to smuck right into him. Yeah. It's just getting to the point now where the downforce is getting a little out of control, I think. So
yeah, well, with the technology and how fast the cars are going, you know, that's the same with anything else. The tire compounds are different. You know, last couple of seasons, they were going like super soft, hyper soft, you know, ultimate supreme soft, like, you know, whatever. It's crazy. So the tire compounds are different. The aerodynamics is different. You know, going into the hybrid motors and all the little louvers they put on and take off on the vehicle. Of course, it's going to make it faster, but you know, everything's all, there's a balance. Everything's all relative.
As a racing driver, you always want to drive the fastest stuff, and you always want to drive the most dynamic cars and the cars that handle the best and the cars that are, you know, big balls, flat out corners, and you want to see what that's like and if you can actually do it. Are you going to need your left foot to hold your right foot down when you're going through a corner? You know, you always want to feel those sensations when you're a racing driver. But if you're a fan and you're sitting in the grandstands, you could care less about how fast the car is going through the corner. You want to see some races.
Yeah, but you look at this past,
you want to see these guys go ahead.
You look at this past season where it was clearly evident that Ferrari, they were working on their top line, straight line speed.
Yeah.
Mercedes had the cornering. They had, you know, the drivability around the corners. And Ferrari even admitted that Mercedes is taking them on the corners.
Yeah.
It's I'm lucky because I've had the opportunity to sit in almost the exact same seat at Silverstone for a turbo hybrid era Formula One race and a current iteration MotoGP race. And we talk about the noise and the experience and the volume of sound that the current Formula One cars produce. It's certainly not what it was in the naturally aspirated era. In fact, and I quite like the sounds, and I was fortunate enough that I saw a 2016 race and I saw a 2018 race. So I got to see the differences, because I guess there's been a couple iterations of the current generation of the formula in the turbo hybrid era. But I could say pretty definitively that a current generation MotoGP bike is significantly louder and produces significantly more volume of sound and experience than a Formula One car. It's It's crazy that that 1 liter engine sitting under the driver,
one little piston.
Yeah, it's absurd. And again, I wasn't lucky enough to see a lot of live Formula One prior to the turbo hybrid era.
Yeah.
But I hear people harkening back to that era and that experience was like. I don't know it, but I know what MotoGP sounds like. And holy, that's a different experience. Yeah. Like you feel it in your chest, you feel it in your spine, you feel it in the stands. And these are motorbikes.
Yeah.
And even as the pack breaks apart over the course of the race, because in MotoGP it's very similar to F1, where you've got some top tier teams, you have Honda, you have Yamaha, and then the rest of the field kind of splinters apart. But even when it's one or two bikes going through a corner and you're sitting adjacent to them, you feel it in every bone in your body. I can't imagine what it would be like to be in one of those cars or on one of those bikes. Incredible. I can't even imagine.
Getting Simply Safe home security is like getting commercial grade enterprise level security, but for your own home. Think about the security that Fortune 500 companies use. They need to know that police are going to be on the scene immediately, and this is exactly the kind of security you're going to get with Simply Safe. If there's a break-in, Simply Safe uses real video evidence to give police an eyewitness account of the crime, and that means that police will dispatch up to 350% faster than for a normal burglar alarm. With Simply Safe, you get comprehensive protection for your home. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. Entry, motion, and glass break sensors guard inside. Plus, Simply Safe protects your home from fires, water damage, and carbon monoxide poisoning. And it's all monitored 24/7 by live security professionals. You can set up your system yourself with no tools needed, or Simply Safe's experts can do it for you. And it only costs 50 cents a day with no contracts. So go to simplysafe.com/overtime today to get free shipping on your order, plus a 60-day money-back guarantee. That's simplysafe.com/overtime to save on home security today. simplysafe.com/overtime.
When it comes to engine noise, I'm firmly from the Spinal Tap school of thought, and, you know, turn it up to 11, you know, as loud as possible, you know.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's move on now and talk about something. I've been thinking about the perfect name of this meeting of the minds here. and how about we should pay homage to both motorsport and to Canada's national sport hockey. So why don't we call this Puck for May? There you go. Any takers?
Well done.
Nice. Eye rolls all around. But anyways, that's a nice little segue to get me to where I want to go. But 2020 is going to be a really cool year in Formula One for Canadian Formula One fans and Canadian motorsport fans in general, because we have two guys that are going to be racing in F1, Lance Stroll and Nick Latifi. And so, Tim, I'm just going to ask you,
absolutely,
how does that raise the profile of Canadian race drivers and Canadian motorsport in general to have these two guys in F1?
Well, on what type of a level, though? Do you know, because if you look at it, you know, broadcasting television, people watching on TV, I think it's not going to change. Like, it'll change a bit. I don't think it'll be huge. The numbers for F1 are massive in Canada. I mean, I don't think Canadians really understand just how big this sport has become in Canada over the last 5 years. It's been an incredible rate of progression in that form. Having two Canadians, does it help? Yeah, I mean, it helps a little bit. I think one of the biggest factors is, can they win? And if they do win, then you're going to start getting, you know, certain people starting to watch who have never watched racing before, getting up at 9 a.m. to turn on the TV or to start streaming.
You're on the West Coast right now.
West Coast, 6 a.m. or
5, 6 a.m.
You know what? But you're going to start getting the person who knows absolutely nothing about Formula One watching at that point. Having two Canadians in F1 on a full-time basis for the first time in history for racing fans in Canada who understand, that is a massive story. It is huge. And I think that we really need to start pumping that story out, just because, there's never been two doesn't make it it's just such a big deal, because, you know, we've never had something like this happen to us as a nation. it's extremely hard to get into Formula One. Everyone seems to think that if you got this big checkbook, you can just write your way into it. But that's not how it works.
No.
Like, this is not how it works. I mean, you can have all the money in the world. There's still no chance that you're going to get into Formula One. You have to win. You have to get a super license. You have to have the right chops. You have got to make sure, because let's talk about Nicholas. Nicholas is a driver who has worked his ass off from day one to get to where he is. He's never had anything handed to him. He's had to work for every single thing that he's ever been given. And to go through the levels of motorsport and to do the things that Nicholas has had to do to get to where he is impossible. It is so impossible. I can't even describe to you the level at which and the things that he has had to do to get to Formula One. Now, once he gets into Formula Two, gets on a good team with Dams, they're able to coach him, bring him along, and he's able to bring his natural ability to the team, and they're able to massage that. You have to remember that they're Formula One teams. They're talking to the Formula Two teams. They're trying to find out, what is he good at? What is he not good at? What can he improve at? What do we need to do to make him better? And what do you need to do to make him better?
Yeah.
Right. Williams isn't going to take on, you know, Nicholas last season as a test and reserve driver for the fun of it. Right. So they're not going to just be like, oh, yeah, well, we'll take him. And if he's got some sponsorship, we'll just take that too. And, you know, screw the rest of it. It's kind of like we need to see everything he's doing. Yeah.
Well, you know, based on my experience in pro sports is that it's a very small world. You might be with one team and you might be looking at a driver, whoever, from another one. But it's a small world. Everybody, it's all interconnected. Everybody knows. And, you know, there's very little space to hide secrets.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And the fact that we are going to have two Canadians in Formula One, and to talk about Lance, you know what? I think coming into 2020, this is a big year for Lance. I think this is a year that's going to make or break him, in all honesty. I think he's going to have a great season. I really think Racing Point is going to be a very strong team this upcoming season. 2021 is going to be interesting. Is he going to be still with the team? I think if he has a great season, yes, he will stay with the team. But everyone kind of seems to think that, yeah, his dad owns part of the team, that he will be with them forever. That's not necessarily the case. You have to remember that Lawrence is a businessman, and business needs to, you know, your business needs to work, and you need to make sure you're doing your job to the best of your ability. And that includes driving on the racetrack and qualifying, which is where Lance obviously needs to work.
Well, Mark and I had this discussion in one of our podcasts too with Stroll's father owning the team. Mm-hmm. You know, with his performance, does he keep him, let him go halfway through the season? Don't even get me started with Stroll. Mark, you take it away with what we talked about with Stroll and his father owning the team and everything. It's an interesting
dynamic. In fact, I actually feel better knowing that that's how you feel about the situation, because you know the family, you know Lance, and I would hate to think for a minute that there was this built-in sense of entitlement that, hey, I have a long-term ride with this team because of my father.
Hate
to think that that was the case. Because
Lance has to work for everything too, right?
Totally. I want Lance's mentality to be that I need to earn my spot like every other driver does.
He knows that for sure, 100%. And I think for Lance, if he can just get control of the qualifying and learn from Sergio, I honestly think he's going to have a dynamite season. A lot of people don't really understand, and a lot of the people who I talk to on Twitter, you know, after qualifying, and people are so frustrated, and they get so mad at Lance, and they start saying,
That's us.
Yeah. One of the things that you need to take into consideration is that he's come from a Williams team that was at its worst. At its worst. And then taking him out of that situation, putting him into a car, and then it's basically a Frankenstein car at this point, because Racing Point started the season with their 2018 car, guys. Yeah. They started 2019 with their 2018 car.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you're expecting this young man to figure this car out like Sergio Perez already has, because he's been with this team since day one.
Yep.
He's been in this car for a number of years. He knows how it works. He knows how to get the best out of it. For Lance, he's coming into a situation where there was no way he was going to do well in qualifying. There just wasn't. It was unrealistic for people to set expectations for him to be as fast as Sergio Perez, who's really fast to begin with, right? So those expectations set way too high.
Yeah, I think I think our frustrations, Mark and I, is the fact that Stroll is Canadian. I think
we're so emotionally invested.
Yeah, we just want him to do well as a Canadian driver. We want him to do well, and with what we've seen of him so far, you know, we're just on the fence. We know that he's got consistency, that he is a good driver. I think our expectations were a bit higher.
His story is an interesting one, right? Because, and I think I heard you talked about this on your podcast. He makes the jump from Formula 3 to Formula 1. He doesn't even make that intermediary step. He wins the F3 title and he's brought right into the Williams family. He's paired next to Felipe Massa in 2017, and for all intents and purposes, and based on everything I've heard, that wasn't necessarily a bad relationship, but it was by no means a mentorship. And despite that, he still qualifies on the front row in Italy, and he pulls in a podium in Baku, which is still the highlight of his career.
Yep.
2018 was a disaster by any means. He's paired next to Sorokin, who's by all accounts a nice kid, but he's in his first season of Formula One. The team is at its absolute worst. And then I think the best thing that could possibly have happened to him in that circumstance is that he was extracted from that situation. So for all of the negatives associated with the Racing Point situation last year, the best thing that could possibly have happened to him was that he was taken out of that situation. And this is where I have a little bit of concern for Nicholas Latifi, because as much skill and as capable as he is, and as mature and as professional as he is as an individual, I worry about him now going into that situation, because I'm not convinced it's fundamentally different than it was when, and maybe you can speak to this, but I'm not convinced it's fundamentally different than it was when Lance was there.
Well, in terms of the dynamic of the team has totally changed. I mean, Williams has cleaned house from top to bottom. I think everything that happened with Patty Lowe being there and everything that happened with that situation and him taking his leave of absence or however they said bye-bye to him and then going in and restructuring everything, I think was a great thing.
Yeah.
I think one of their key issues is they've had some problems with their wind tunnel in the past, and that kind of led them down some wrong roads at the end of the day. And I think Patty Lowe's idea of leaving what was working to try and create something that was different just didn't work. And it took the team in such a wrong direction. They spent so much money and lost so much money that now they're in this rebuilding stage. From what I've heard, it sounds like they're headed in the right direction. Talking to George Russell, last month and hearing what he had to say, he really did feel that the team actually was going in the right direction, because George actually isn't one to mince his words. I think for those of us who follow the sport really closely, we've heard him actually lash out at Williams before. I know I have. And so listening to him at the end of the year and how pleased he was with where the team started to where they finished is a good thing. All things considered, in qualifying, they're what, 3 to 4 seconds off of the pace. If they're somehow able to make some of that gap up, they can compete with the back end of the midfield, which is great.
Yeah.
And for Nicholas and where he's concerned, in terms of who is under pressure at that team in terms of the drivers, it's certainly not Nicholas. This is George Russell's year coming up, and the pressure's on George. George needs to deliver, or he could be out of Formula One.
Yeah, well, look at a guy that, he's a Mercedes driver.
Yeah, exactly.
And look
at
a guy that was in a similar situation just a couple of years ago. I mean, I jokingly referred to him earlier in the show, and that was Pascal Wehrlein.
Yeah.
He was a Mercedes reserve driver in the Hamilton Rosberg era, and where is he now?
Yeah.
Well,
for Nicholas, I think one of the big things, I think he's in such a great situation, and everyone's, a lot of Canadians have come up to me, or they've tweeted at me, or they've sent me messages saying, oh, this sucks, he's at Williams, we got a Canadian, we got two Canadians in F1, and now the second one's going back to Williams, like, come on. And I'm just like, actually, you know what, this isn't a bad thing. I think this is a really great opportunity for Nicholas to learn. You know, you have to remember that if I'm, you know, let's say I go from Formula 2 and then all of a sudden Ferrari wants to sign me and I'm getting into Formula 1 for the first time and you're driving Ferrari, like, think of the pressure that's on your shoulders at that point. And let's say you can't figure out the tires. You can't figure the tires out. You can't figure the car. The
Mick
car's
Schumacher,
not made for
are you.
You
listening?
Like, yeah, exactly. 100%. And we'll get to that in a second because you're definitely going down the right path on that one. You get into the car, and your career's finished. You're done after six races. That's it. It's over for you. Yep. So for Nicholas, this is, I think, in my personal opinion, I think this is the best place for him. I think this is the best place that he can learn with no pressure. Yep. The only thing I think that's going to stop him from being around Formula One for a second season is qualifying performances. What is the gap between him and George?
Yeah.
And how big is that gap in qualifying? I'm not concerned about the racing whatsoever. Nicholas is an amazing race car driver. Racing, the same with Lance. They're the two of them are unbelievable racing drivers. I think qualifying is where a lot of the things are going to be determined. Can he keep up with George? Absolutely. I think he's just as fast as George. And I think after the first five races, I think Nicholas will have things under control.
I was lucky enough that I was at the Grove. I was at the Williams factory in late 2016 in Grove. As much as a lot of people have criticized Williams, and they become a bit of, I hate to say it, but they become a bit of a joke, despite their immense heritage and their driver's titles and their constructor's titles. But you go to that facility and it is still an absolute world-class facility.
100%.
The wind tunnels and the factory and their heritage center and their office space. It's still a world-class facility. They have the infrastructure. And I'm bringing up Wikipedia right in front of me, but 2014, and again, it was a bit of a transition year. You're transitioning from the naturally aspirated V8s into the turbo hybrids.
Yep.
But they still finished third in the construction. That year they finished ahead of Ferrari.
It is frightening to see how quickly they disappeared into the abyss. I mean, just going back a couple of years ago to when it was Valtteri Bottas and Felipe Massa, I mean, they basically were the best of the rest of the rest.
For sure.
They weren't the Red Bull, but they were kind of that McLaren Renault team that we saw like in 2019. But I mean, to see where they've really just gone down into the depth of darkness is frightening, because I mean, if you even look around the room that we're sitting in right now, I mean, I've got Damon Hill's championship car. I got Villeneuve. Yeah. Excuse me. So I mean, their heritage and just the knowledge that this team had. I mean, I grew up in an era where I was a massive Nigel Mansell fan. I mean, they were the team to be with. I mean, you go through the 80s, you go through the 90s with Hill, and then with Jacques, you go into the early 2000s. There's a Ralf Schumacher hat there with him and Juan Pablo. And I mean, then even into the turbo hybrid era with Massa and Bottas. And then all of a sudden it's just like the bottom fell out and it's scary. So, I mean, excuse me, from the point of view that a lot of Canadian fans might be alarmed or very concerned for Nicholas going there right now, they can only go up, right?
Exactly.
I can't see them sinking any lower. And hopefully, you know, as Tim was just saying, that they've cleaned house top to bottom. Is they've got to turn it around at some point.
Well, just to be a driver, any driver to say that, hey, I got into Formula One, like you were saying, how hard it is, just the fraction, or just any driver jumping into even a short season into Formula One and say, hey, I got into Formula One. At least somebody saw something in me that I was able to compete in Formula One.
Yeah, there was it's a perfect example you make of it, but like I remember reading something on Twitter not too long ago about Karun Chandhok. Someone was bashing the guy because he was now doing Sky Sports work.
Yeah, he's an announcer.
And they're all like, you know, what do you know? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, dude.
He drove.
They're like, yeah, he may have had a cup of coffee, but like, he got in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, just to get in is impossible. People just don't seem to understand
that. What people see is that 5 minutes in the sport. What they don't see is the 10 or 15 years
that it gets there.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Just to add to what you're saying, too, I grew up in the UK, and I recall every Sunday for me was roast lunch with my grandparents and then watching the F1 race. And it was all about Williams in the 90s, and the UK was an institution.
Yeah.
And they were popular because they were a family-run team.
Yep.
They were British-based. They hired British. It was all about the British history. principally about the British drivers, and Nigel Mansell was a big part of that heritage. And then for me to move over to Canada and then to see Villeneuve make that jump and to make it with Williams, it's been a little bit painful to see this. So it's very personal for me, this situation, just because there's kind of some family linkages there. But I'm excited to hear that we all agree that they've bottomed out and there's nowhere to go but up.
Yeah,
I really do feel from the things that I've heard that they're going in the right direction. I really do think that Williams, obviously they're not going to light the timing sheets on fire this year, but I really do feel that they are going in the right direction. I think what's going to determine a lot of how far they go this season is where they start spending their money, because I can see the team having the first 10 races being really solid for them as a team, and then I can see it teetering off only because they're taking that extra revenue and dumping it into the 2021 car. Because I think that's going to affect a lot of these racing teams as the season kind of progresses. I think a lot of the racing teams are going to have a look at summer break. Where are we in the championship, in the Constructors Championship, Drivers Championship? Where do we sit? And how much money should we keep spending on this season before we pull the plug and start dumping all of our resources?
It is a weird year that way. I mean, we were sort of stuck in this sort of no man's land between the current regs and the new regs coming in for 2020. But before we go down that road and we start to wind things up here, Tim, I just wanted to get your two cents on Lance. You know, we were just talking about it a little bit. We kind of touched on it here and there just about the qualifying. I mean, was it 15 races in a row he didn't make it out of Q3, whatever it is? Or sorry, Q1.
Q1.
But, you know, he was saying something not so long ago. It comes down to the details, and you're just saying that, that him and Nicholas are really good racing drivers.
You'd like to know what those details are, don't you?
Well, I'm sure Lance does as well, right? So what is it? Where does he need to focus down? Because I'm sure when you get to that level, it's about focusing on the big picture, but it's all those little details that add up to the larger sum. I guess you could call it.
You know, one of the things has to be with details is set up on the car. And when Lance kind of says details, he's not really talking too much about race and the car and the setup of the car during race trim. It's more along the lines of like qualifying and setting up the car determines on what is happening with the actual tire and how the tire is actually working with the race car itself. So I think for Lance, one of the things that he means by details is how is he driving the car under the current setup? What does he need to tweak? And then how is he going to keep that tire underneath him for the full lap of a qualifying lap? Because if you think of it this way, when these drivers go out to start a qualifying lap, they do what's called a prep lap. Okay, a prep lap is to get the car and to get the tire up to operating temperature. How do they do that? They weave back and forth, but a lot of it comes from braking and how hard they use the brakes, how much the brakes generate heat, how much the pad generates heat on top of the disc, and the disc then heats the actual wheel, which then heats the actual tire itself and then inflates and et cetera, et cetera. So a prep lap is preparing the tire to start the quali lap. You don't want to start the quali lap with an overprepared tire. One of the things that Lance struggled at the beginning of his career was overdriving the car. People would always say, oh, he's overdriving the car. Okay, well, he's overdriving the car. He's overdriving the tire. Okay, he's doing more with the tire than it actually can handle. So he's learned that. Okay, he smoothed himself out. What it comes down to is the details. Do I need a little bit more front wing to get a little more heat into the tire at the start of my lap? But I also have to remember that little bit of front wing I just added is going to affect me six corners later. And now I'm going to need to make an adjustment for that corner. So maybe a corner that I'm better at, I'm now going to have to sacrifice and be a little slower at so I can get the ultimate from the tire. So one of the things from Lance is just overcooking the tire on some of his laps. He gets frustrated and he overdrives the car sometimes still. But if you can iron out those small, tiny little engineering details, which he will, working with Sergio, I think has taught him a lot. We've seen in FP2s, we've seen in FP3s, you know, Lance has been sometimes faster than Sergio. And people look at FP2 and FP3 as, oh, they're just practicing. Okay, What I want people to do now is when you watch FP2 and FP3, watch with the intent that the beginning is qualifying. These guys are trying to figure out the car for qualifying. They're pushing the car, what it's going to simulate, what their qualifying laps are going to look like. Okay? And then when you watch the end of FP2, it's going to be more, you know, racy. The cars are going to be going a lot slower because now they're working on race trim. They're working on how to drive the car in race conditions, how much fuel to save, when to push, where can they attack, et cetera, et cetera. So when they get the cars dialed in FP2, FP3 is the finalizer, where it's kind of like, this is what you have when we go into qualifying 3 hours from now or whatever, two or three hours from now. Okay, so what you've got right now, that needs to work, okay? Because we can't make another adjustment to the car in FP3 because you're going to go out in qualifying. You're not going to know what you have.
Mm.
Okay, so that, again, is a detail unto itself that these drivers tend to need to learn when they get into Formula One. And that's one of those things that Lance is talking about.
Kind of, you got to learn it on the job.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's another thing, right? Not enough testing.
Oh, it's not like the old days where it's like unlimited miles almost.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. No, it's like, so you really rely heavily on that experience. And you look at a guy like Lewis Hamilton I remember when Lance came into F1 and everyone was just giving me the gears where they were just like, this guy sucks. Da, da, da. He can't do anything because he crashed out of. Actually, he didn't crash out of. He DNF'd the first race because he had a brake disc blow up. And then he got crashed out of a few, one from Carlos Sainz. And then the other one, I think it was Perez, crashed him out. And so he didn't collect any points until finally Canada, where he finally collected some points, right? One of those things is that he never had the experience coming in.
Yeah.
Missing Formula 2 was a huge, huge mistake. But at the end of the day, if Formula One comes knocking,
who's going to turn that down?
You got to answer the door. There's just no way. Yeah. You just figure it out as you get there. Like, you'll get there and then just figure it out as it goes along. But if you see after Canada, he actually started to match Felipe Massa on pace after that. And so it all comes down to experience at the end of the day with Formula One nowadays. Like, these drivers, usually the drivers that have the experience usually tend to be the fastest ones.
Hey guys, I just want to take a quick break away from the show to talk to you about something I'm really excited about, and that's today's show is being sponsored by The Athletic, a subscription-based sports news site featuring quality content for real sports fans that goes way beyond the box score. The Athletic is setting a new standard for sports news because their coverage focuses on a mix of long-form journalism, original reporting, and in-depth analysis. At The Athletic, you're going to get quality journalism and in-depth coverage of your favorite team from local writers who really know what's going on. Plus, you're going to get great content from national writers you already know, like Jay Glazer, Mike Sando, and Michael Lombardi. Get exclusive player profiles, deep dives on analytics, team power rankings, and fantasy sports insights you won't find anywhere else. Each subscriber gets a personalized feed of stories, live writer Q&As, and more. Just download the Athletic app, pick your favorite teams, and the Athletic will begin surfacing all the latest on the players and storylines that matter to you. The Athletic is clutter-free reading with no ads, no pop-ups, no autoplay video or clickbait. It's just good content because The Athletic is created for fans and not for advertisers. Your subscription to The Athletic is going to get you a ton of great things, including full access to all sports, teams, cities, and writers. The Athletic lets you customize and choose the content you care about, and it's going to get even better as more cities and writers are added to the site. So you're still not sold? Just check out some of the great journalists currently writing for The Athletic. For Major League Baseball, there's Ken Rosenthal, Jason Stark, Peter Gammons, and Jim Bowden. For the NBA, there's Shams Charania, David Aldridge, Sam Amick, and Zach Harper. For the NFL, there's Jay Glazer, Michael Lombardi, Lindsey Jones, Dane Brugler, and Bob Stern. And I know quite a few of the soccer people at The Athletic, and they're absolutely first class. For example, I was reading an article the other day written by my buddy Matt Pence called How Nike, Adidas, and E-Commerce Threaten the Survival of Mom-and-Pop Soccer Shops. It was a really great read, and honestly, it was a real eye-opener. So if you're ready to get started and would like to save 40% off a yearly subscription to The Athletic's complete library of written, audio, and video content covering professional college sports at a national local level, go to theathletic.com/overtime. That's theathletic.com/overtime. Once again, if you want to save 40% off a yearly subscription to The Athletic, go to, and this is all lowercase, theathletic.com/overtime.
All right, just before we bring it full circle and just speculate on what we could expect to see in 2020 this year, we just mentioned Mick Schumacher really briefly in passing, but he looks to be maybe the next up-and-comer that's really sort of knocking on the door in F1. But the question that I've had, and obviously he's in the Ferrari driver system, is that after 2021, say for whatever reason, Sebastian is not back at Ferrari next year, do we see a situation, and I mean, it would be pretty much unheard of at Ferrari to have two young guys in Charles Leclerc and then an extremely young guy in Mick Schumacher. Apart from, you know, his background and growing up with it and just his pedigree and his talent on its own, I just think that that's too soon to see Mick Schumacher in Formula One at Ferrari at any rate.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree. I think I think you guys would as well. I mean, if we go back to a lot of the conversations that we have been having in here, you know, a lot of you have your star driver and then you've got a pupil or someone you're bringing up. And I think for Ferrari, it's like I'd said, they want to keep Sebastian Vettel. They want to have that rock, you know, that they've got.
And they're still cultivating Leclerc, right? They've invested in Leclerc.
And you need to make sure that, like, if you're bringing first, Mick has got to do well in Formula 2. Like, let's be honest here, okay?
Yeah. That's the main point. And that would be my point exactly, is he is not an established rock star at the Formula 2 level. And you've seen now Nyck de Vries will have vacated his position in Formula 2. Nicholas Latifi will now have vacated his position in Formula 2.
Luca Giotto.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. If he's going to demonstrate that he can win at the Formula 2 level, he has to do it this year. And if he does it, I don't think there's any Formula 1 runway at all. So we maybe are getting ahead of ourselves a little bit because he hasn't established himself. And we've seen a wealth of talent come through that Formula 2 pipeline the last two seasons. Yeah. And of all of them, whether it's the Albons and the Latifis and everyone else,
Russell Leclerc,
he's probably the one that I have the least amount of confidence in. Now, it's a great story. It's an unbelievable marketing story. It's a great narrative. It's something I'd love to talk about. But even if he was ready, does Ferrari not maybe leverage its Sauber/Alfa Romeo?
Exactly. That was the point I wanted to get to. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I see him very much like if he comes into Formula One in 2020, I expect to see him in a Haas or an Alfa Romeo rather than in the Scuderia itself.
It's kind of like, okay, well, if you're who are you gonna let go, right? Raikkonen,
Grosjean.
Grosjean doesn't. There's another one, right? So who are you gonna let go? Are you gonna? I don't think Ferrari has say over who goes at Haas. Haas has their say on the driver front. Yeah. But for Alfa Romeo, they don't really have a choice.
Ferrari
calls the shots but over there.
I would love to be that guy in Gunther Steiner's office when he tells Ferrari where to go when they say, we want Mick Schumacher in your team. I'd love to hear that reaction.
I think it's going to come down to if Giovinazzi has a poor season and if what's Raikkonen's desire, I think, at the end of the season. Because honestly, guys, I'll throw this out there. Like, how long do you think they let that guy race? Yeah. Honestly,
Kimi?
Though,
I
like Kimi Raikkonen.
I know from personality
to take the fandom out of it.
And just
logically.
Yeah, but he's got history. I think he's still a good driver. I just don't think he's been given the last few seasons.
Smacked at the end of the season, man. Like Giovinazzi smacked him around when he figured it out.
Yeah, well, with Raikkonen going back to Alfa Romeo, to the team where he was going to start his career and wanted to end his career, I still think he's a good driver. He just needs the car, the tools, and the opportunity to compete. His first season back with Alfa Romeo, I think they're just trying to piece those puzzles together, right?
I think they're using a lot of his experience to help set some foundations in place for the future. I mean, why wouldn't you want like a guy like Kimi Raikkonen, even though he's at the end of your career,
help you clean things
up.
Team?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Clean things up.
And you can't understate the value that having a championship driver on a midfield team has when it comes to marketing and selling sponsorships for your team. Like if I'm Alfa Romeo, I know I'm probably not going to win a title and I'm probably not going to compete for podiums. But if I have this guy on my roster who's won a title and he brings attention and sponsorship,
he adds some value
off the track. again, for me, I'd want to be more organic, and
but
I just
doesn't
want to
do anything off the track, right? Like, sure, honestly,
Kimi still, I think, has the best quote ever in an interview, and I think it was from Brazil a couple of years ago. I think you're laughing. I think you maybe know where I'm going with this, but he was asked something. Did you see the podium presentation? He said, "Oh no, I was over there taking a." You know what? Yeah. So, you know, that's a classic Kibbe quote. They're not trying to be rude or offensive. He's just telling everybody he was doing,
like,
even though
he did. Did you hear Pele singing the national anthem or something like that?
And on that note, let's spend the last 10 minutes here, just wind it all up, bring it full circle. Let's look into the crystal ball for 2020. Christian Horner was saying something this week that he expects that it could be a classic season between Mercedes, Ferrari, and Red Bull, unless somebody pulls something out of a rabbit in the hat. Based on that, I'm hoping to see more races like we saw in Austria, which I thought was phenomenal for a number of reasons, because it was the first time anybody really took it to Mercedes last year, where they were clearly off the pace. But I'd love to see races like Hockenheim every week, but that mayhem and
sprinklers, and the sprinklers,
the birdie innovation, and not to mention we're going to see two new races this year.
Yes,
so we get to see Zandvoort, whatever that reconstituted, rebuilt track looks like. The one that we're super excited about is that hybrid track in Vietnam.
Yeah. Hanoi. Yeah. How do you pronounce it? Is this Hanoi? Am I pronouncing it wrong?
I don't know. You looked Hanoi? At me because I'm Asian?
No. Oh, I thought you said it. I thought you just said it. Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought I heard it. And no, I was like, wait, how did you pronounce it? Because I pronounced it Hanoi, and I don't want to get that wrong.
Especially if you're going to be talking about it.
I know. That's why I asked you. Because I thought I heard something different come out of your mouth.
I think Christian Horner's right. And I saw that quote as well. And at first, I didn't understand it, because classic F1 season, does that mean multiple teams competing? And then I kind of unpacked it a little bit. It's like, no, he means classic as in the turbo hybrid era, and it's going to be those three teams. And I fear that's what it's going to be. But it doesn't mean it's not going to be an entertaining or an interesting season.
And yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be another cookie cutter season.
At the top.
For sure. I think the teams are just going to pull out all the stops. I think they need to push the envelope for this season in order to take that data and that information into 2021. So what I'm hoping for is that the teams for this season just push the envelope, just give the cars, no team orders, let the drivers just do what they want, collect that data, and make those changes for 2021, because this is it. Like, let them race, just pull out all the stops.
I guess that's really the question, right? And you and I have debated this pretty fiercely. Like, if I'm not one of those top three teams and I can compete for constructors and a driver's title, what motivation do I have to, obviously there's constructors points and there's cash available to win, but how motivated am I to compete this year or invest resources in this year when really I should probably be looking forward to a partial reset in 2021. Like, I know the engine formula is not going to change significantly, but how much of my energy do I spend in 2021 and just let the chips fall?
Well, that's why I say
may
go for broke, because know what? Let's make this season fun.
I want it to be fun.
And, you know, Hamilton win his next championship and then go into 2021 with a clean slate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I feel that we're going to be in for a season that kind of emulated the second half of the 2019 season. I think that's what we're going
to be. That's what I would hope to see
be in for. Yeah. I think once you kind of get to that summertime break in 2020 and we see where are the drivers, who is actually in contention, and as for the teams, who's in contention for what positions. And it's at that point we are going to see a dramatic drop off from these teams from each other, because everyone's going to cut the spending and all of that resource is going to go into the development of their 2021 car. I think one of the biggest things that people may not understand is, one, the amount of money that they're going to have to spend to make these cars. I know there's this budget cap thing, but they're actually going over and above what the theoretical budget cap is for 2021.
And that won't be enforced. At least in 2021.
It won't be enforced at all until you get to 2021. So you could throw $300 million at your 2021 car.
Now, right?
Yeah, you can front
load
it.
You won't get any flack for that. So you have to remember that the amount of changes that are about to happen to Formula One are huge. Like, we are going through a massive overhaul in the technical and the rules, like massive. Like, this isn't a little tiny tweak that they were just like, oh, yeah, we'll just change this. This is a rebuild. This is an entire rebuild from ground up.
Right? Yeah. I mean, the changes that they brought in 2017 were significant, but this is like a complete line in the sand. Yeah. I mean, it's like
new
apples
everything.
And oranges.
Clean slate.
Like,
yeah. New clean slate.
Yeah. Yeah, this is like, okay, you know, 2021, we made them a little bit wider. We gave them a little bit more downforce. This is, we need everything totally redone, and the tires are going to be redone too.
Smaller wheels. Like, I'm excited for...
Bigger wheels.
Bigger wheels.
I'm sorry.
18.
Yeah.
18,
sorry. Yep.
And like I heard, and teams aren't on board with that. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants these 18-inch wheels. They do not want it.
What's the driver then? Because is it a mark?
Drivers don't want it either. Nobody wants this.
But what's driving the change? is it the marketing piece? Just that it's easier to sell low profile tires if that's what the drivers are racing on?
You know, you're trying to assimilate. Hey, you know, this is what you have in your road car, well, we run these on Formula One cars, and then they can take that technology too and then put it on the road
but
cars
for
as well.
Practicality, you know, going with a smaller wheel, the centrifugal force, the amount of rubber that you're going to put on the tire, the performance. It makes sense to go with a smaller wheel as opposed to a bigger wheel.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, the bigger wheel now is creating a lot of problems with the teams in terms of weight. The cars are now way too heavy.
Oh,
they're
so much more unsprung weight too,
and they're so worried that they're so worried that the cars are going to be as slow as Formula 2 cars.
Yeah,
like that's what they're worried about right now, and that's kind of sad to hear that, right?
Yeah,
it's like okay, well, maybe you probably shouldn't have done the 18-inch wheels. You know, if it's going to cause this much of a headache,
if there's anything that can zap performance from a car, it's added unsprung weight and it's big. Big unnecessary wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's that tuner mentality where bigger is better, but in a performance car, it absolutely zaps performance, just like you said.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of cool to say, okay, well, we have this on the cars that you have in your cars. I mean, I've got the paddle shift in my Mitsubishi and, you know, I've got traction control. I've got anti-lock brakes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, what makes it to a road car from a Formula One car is really watered down and I got a set of Pirellis on there too. You know, that's really awesome. But I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I know that they still want that relatability between Formula One and road cars, no matter how far of a distance, you know, it is like they're polar opposites, comes off the car onto my car.
You're
for
opening
example.
Up a can of worms.
I know
that, because I'm ready to adjust.
But from a performance standpoint, I have three identical cars. I drive Scion XBs. And
you have a collection of Scion XBs, actually.
So I just switched.
What is wrong with you?
I have three Scion XBs with one with 15 inch wheel, 16 inch wheel on the second one, and a 17. And when I hop into each one of those different cars, the cars are identical. They're bone stock. But when I drive each one of those cars, their handling, their performance, their drivability, completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So I can say that. I have a more comfortable ride in the 15-inch with the more rubber. The 17 cosmetically looks good, but the handling, the cornering, it's not working for me.
Totally.
I want to jump back here for a second because, Mark, you raised some good points. And I actually haven't really gotten to talk about this with anybody yet. But the frustrating part of what I've been seeing with Formula One and in relation with like road cars is – the technology that is happening in Formula One right now is incredible. Absolutely incredible. And the amount of performance that they're getting from just a V6, a hybrid V6.
A hybrid V6, yeah.
And where the energy for the hybrid is actually coming from is remarkable. And it's kind of like we're in this stage of like, why isn't that technology like moving its way over faster?
It's cost
to road cars.
It's Williams, like they have like a completely separate entity to their company where they basically develop that for road cars. Do they not?
They do
for performance engineering
performance
or whatever
engineering,
it is. Yeah.
And some of it is for Formula E. Some of the batteries
that's correct.
Battery technology is not new. This is stuff that's been around for a while. I think it just comes down from a marketing and for a cost. Like if they put all this new high end technology in the cars, they're limiting their market and people buying these vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that I want to see what they do with. I mean, Formula E is great. I do like Formula E. It has its place, its own place, and I enjoy the racing when it's on. Formula One is its own thing as well, and I enjoy what it does there. If they want to be compatible with what's happening out on the road, then I believe what they're trying to do with biofuels, synthetic fuels, trying to find different ways of helping the environment, whether or not, you know, that is in correlation with what they're, you know, were trying to do in the past. It does seem like this is the direction they want to take. From the people I've spoken with within Formula One, trying to develop a synthetic base could be, I would say, a game changer in terms of our actual road going vehicles and the environment. I think it would smash everything. Like, I know electric vehicles are, you know, electric vehicles, they also do, you know, emit. Like, they're not, you know, electric vehicles are, they're emitters as well as road going cars. They're both the same. There's differences in both, obviously, but I'm really fascinated by what they're trying to do with biofuels, synthetic fuels, what they can get out of it.
Yep.
I think I read an article in, I think it was a Globe and Mail, about a gentleman who was doing something called carbon capture, and it was being done here in BC. That right there. Mm-hmm. And like, technology like that is absolutely fascinating.
It's really cool.
And what they're actually able to do and how they can reuse a lot of that energy. And he was basically pulling CO2 out of the air and then finding a way of burning it down into a liquid form and then using it in a gas-powered engine.
Yep.
And it was burning clean. Like, that's fascinating.
No question that there's a misnomer about, and this could be an entirely different podcast and an entirely different.
That's why
different
I said you can of words.
but there's an entirely incorrect misnomer about the positive impact that a truly electric vehicle can potentially have on the environment. And we're very lucky in BC because almost all of our power is green. It's hydro generated. We're very lucky. But if you live in the US Midwest or the South or the West Coast or portions of the East Coast, your power is coming from nuclear generation. It's coming from coal fire plants. It's crazy. Not to mention the environmental impact of basically mining for the elements that are in that battery and building that battery. And not to mention, we're not at that stage yet, but what do we start to do with these batteries when they're end of life? Mm-hmm. Do we break them down? Do we dump them in a well? Do we bury them? Like, there's an environmental cost there. So to your point, if there's a way that we could let some of this technology trickle down into production cars and you can have a truly capable hybrid.
That's basically what I'm trying to say, is kind of like, you know, I would really like to see a lot of this technology coming out of F1 actually being used, because the things that they're doing are tremendous.
The thermal efficiency of these V6s is ridiculous.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, the amount of energy that they get from the thermal part of it, and then the kinetic as well, is mind-blowing. Yeah. The amount of energy they're able to store in those batteries. And I mean, I really do feel that hybrids serve a huge purpose in our everyday road-going lives. I think their
reputation's been damaged, though. I think it's because EVs have become accessible price-wise. Mm. And I think it's perception, and I think it's marketing. And I think if you look at these, to your point, I think if you look at the manufacturers now, they're basically flushing the hybrids out of their production cycles. Mm. Like, they're done. Whatever's there is end of life and they're going to move on. But I think just from a reputational perspective, if somebody's buying a new car, I'll buy true EV simply because the perception is that it's better for the environment. Mm. Even though I'm getting my electricity from a coal fire plant 16 miles away from my house, kind of thing.
Well, I'm going to petition for 2021 season, bring back refueling for Formula One. That was really exciting. Bring back refueling.
The reaction you just got out of Tim. And maybe you can speak to this, because, again, we're speaking purely as fans. I've done some amateur motorbike racing. I have no idea what refueling's like. But as fans, it's super exciting to watch. Yeah. But your reaction.
That's a terrible idea.
Come on.
Horrible.
Kimi Räikkönen ripping out a fuel hose in the Malaysian Grand Prix.
That's a horrible idea.
From a fan's perspective, it's exciting. From a driver's perspective, it's got to be terrifying.
How many times has, like, Räikkönen or Alonso ripped out a fuel hose refueling?
Was it Johnny Herbert way back in the day that had the fuel ignite on his exhaust manifold in the 90s?
That was Jos Verstappen.
I was just putting in my mind, was it Johnny or was it Jos?
Yeah, it was Jos.
Yeah, you're right.
Not from the fact that it's, like, you know, scary and all that kind of stuff. From the fact that it's, like, it would ruin the races, because your races would end up becoming, like, you know, processions. And if and also Formula One coming out and talking about being green and all that kind of stuff. And
I
gotta hammer this home, like, these drivers are doing full race distances on, like, what is it, 105 kilograms of fuel,
something
now,
like something that. Like, yep, that. Like, yep.
Yeah. Like crazy amounts. Yeah. And they're going so fast.
Yeah.
Like the engines are so efficient, and the amount of burn that they're getting from that, and it makes more sense in the direction that F1 wants to take the sport, and I get it, and I'm on board with it, and I honestly don't miss refueling. I know a lot of people really do, but
I'm kind of on the fence about it. But honestly, it's kind of like another variable that makes it kind of interesting. But
I agree.
Personally, like what I like about the current rules is, I like to see how fast can they go. Like the 1.9 second pit stop.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
I know, it's crazy. Yeah.
I can't even look at my watch and figure out what the time is. It just blows my mind.
We were talking on the way in that Netflix series Drive to Survive.
Yep.
It generated so much interest in our building. And there's 1,000 people there, and we were kind of kindred spirits because we're the only two that would watch Formula One. But the amount of excitement that it generated in our building was crazy. But one of the things that people kept asking us about were the pit stops. People couldn't wrap their heads around the pit stops. Like, is that real? What's the catch? Is it camera tricks? Mm-hmm. Like, no, that is legit. That's a 1.9 second camp or like 1.9 second stop. And like, really, they're pulling it's crazy
to get that many people around a car that's coming in.
Yep.
At was it 80 kilometers an hour in the pits? Yep. Come to a standstill.
In sync.
In sync, get four tires off the car, get four tires on the car, get both ends of the car back down on the ground, and that guy's moving again in, say, plus minus 2 seconds.
But also coordinating with other traffic in the pit lane.
Plus the traffic. Ergo the...
And then when you talk about double stacking.
Unsafe release.
Double stacking.
Love the double stack, man. Yeah. It's awesome.
I love the double stack.
I couldn't imagine, and you hear this sometimes as well, people talk about, well, what do we even need a tire change? Like, we do because it's in the regulations and you have to run two different compounds, but we also need it for the sports and for the strategy. So.
Yeah. I think it's got a place in it. I think it looks... And I think it's amazing. Like I say, I want to see how fast they can go.
Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap it up here. We've been going for just over 2 hours now.
Really?
Wow. So I'm going to make a call on my predictions for the 2020 World Championship for the drivers and the constructors. I'm calling Lewis Hamilton world champion, number 7 for him. Runner-up, Charles Leclerc. On the constructor side, I'm calling another Mercedes world championship in the constructors. Runner-up by Ferrari, but they beat Red Bull by a hair.
Wow.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
For me,
I should just let you know that I'm also horribly terrible at calling things like that. So there is a caveat there.
All right. My prediction is going to be Lewis Hamilton for championship, Max Verstappen as runner up or second.
Oh, I hope we see that. Yeah, I hope we see that.
For sure. I think Red Bull's got a really good chance this coming season. Constructors, Mercedes, they've got it dialed in. So I'm saying Mercedes, and then I'm on the fence between Ferrari and Red Bull.
Okay.
So I'm hoping Tim's going to buck the trend here. I think it's going to be Lewis. I want it to be Lewis. I want that narrative. I want that storyline. I want to be able to go into 2021 talking about whether Lewis can become the greatest of all time. I think from a Constructors Championship perspective, it'll be Mercedes. I think Lewis is just going to tally too many points. As a runner-up, that's a tough one. That's a really, really tough one. I hope it's Verstappen because I want that story, but I have a feeling it'll be Leclerc, and I'd be very, very happy if it was.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tim, final word goes to you.
Charles Leclerc wins the championship.
Ooh. Wow, bold one, bold prediction.
Ferrari wins constructors.
Wow, the double championship.
Yeah, I think they're not messing around. I think Charles Leclerc is going to win.
Do you have some inside info that we don't know?
No, I'm just...
He just doesn't need to share it.
I'm just putting it out there and we're going to see what happens.
Okay.
You know, I could be wrong. You know, I always make bold predictions and they rarely ever do come true.
Just speaking from a media point of view, you never divulge your sources on your inside tips because you would be amazed how quickly those inside, those insider tips disappear.
You got to be a good boy, you know?
All right. So we got an interesting mix of predictions. I mean, basically, I'm just going to wrap up my thought is that when it comes to Lewis and when it comes to Mercedes, I can't bet against them until proven otherwise.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. I mean, it's so strong.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's wrap it up there, guys. Before we go, just I'll start with Mark and Gil. Let everybody know where they can find you online, where they can follow you on social media, all those good sort of things.
Well, we're Flash F1, and you can find us on Instagram at Flash F1 @Mark_official. Mark's handling our Twitter, or Mark's wife's handling our Twitter, our Flash F1 Twitter.
Yep, hopefully. hopefully we'll see some updates there. That was one of our commitments on our podcast earlier today. But yeah, and from a podcast perspective, you can find us on all of the major platforms. Obviously, iTunes being the biggest one, but pretty much everything Spotify, else that you can imagine, Spotify, yeah, et cetera. Not on Luminary yet, but working on it.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, you can catch me on Twitter and Instagram @TimHaraney, and it's spelled HaraneY. My podcast, TSN Racing Pod, that's, you can get that anywhere you listen to your podcast except for Spotify. I'm still working on that one. How did you guys get on Spotify?
I'm on Spotify. You're the only one that's not on Spotify.
Yeah. I don't know how to get on it.
Flash F1, baby. Yeah.
Spotify, if you're listening, I would like to talk.
Yeah. I must admit, though, last year when I switched providers to the network I'm with now, they took care of everything.
Really?
There was like a little bit of an in-between time where I was on Spotify before, and then it disappeared there for a little while, and it came back. So
you got to get on Spotify. Yeah, it's about, that's about a quarter of our listenership. It's a big one.
Yeah. There you go. And myself, I'm Mark Daly. You can follow me on Twitter @ScuderiaF1Pod, and the Scuderia F1 Pod you can likewise find on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere else that you listen to your podcast. And that's a wrap for the show. Thanks, guys.
Mark, we want to thank you for hosting and collab here for the podcast and for all of us. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And, you know, I must say that after sitting down here with you guys in this room, in this studio, I've done close to 450 episodes of this, and also my soccer podcast. We've had TV crews in this room before.
That's awesome.
And this has been, you know, a real highlight. So I thank you all three of you guys for coming out tonight. Yeah, it's been a blast.
Yeah, my pleasure. I had a lot of fun. Thanks again for having me in here. I mean, this is a cool setup you got in here. It's like every racing fan man cave, whatever you want to call it, sort of lair you want to call it. It's awesome. I think it's really cool down here. I love what you do, and I love your work too, Mark. Yeah,
thank you very much.
Great job with everything, man, and I appreciate you hosting us.
All right, well, there you go. A very, very big thank you to Tim Haraney from TSN Sports and to Mark and Gil from the Flash F1 Podcast. If you didn't catch any of their info right at the very end there on their social media, or you can download and listen to their shows, don't worry. Just go into the description for this podcast. I've got all the links to all their social media channels, their download pages, and all that can all be found there, so it's all good. Anyways, that's it. That's a wrap for this week. Actually, it's not a wrap for this week. I'll be back at the usual time in a couple of days with the regular program. Until then, if you have any questions or comments or feedback, easiest way to get in touch with me is on Twitter @ScuderiaF1Pod, or you can email me @ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. And that's it. That's a wrap. Have a great couple of days, and I'll talk to you soon. Ciao.
Thanks for listening to the Scuderia F1 Podcast. If you want to get the show notes for this episode, then head over to ScuderiaF1Pod.com. Want to get in touch with us? Then email us @ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com.